Matthew 22, verse 15. Then the Pharisees went and plotted how to entangle him in his words. And they sent their disciples to him, along with the Herodians, saying, Teacher, we know that you are true and teach the way of God truthfully, and you do not care about anyone's opinion, for you are not swayed by appearances. Tell us then what you think. Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not? But Jesus, aware of their malice, said, Why put me to the test, you hypocrites? Show me the coin for the tax. And they brought him a denarius. And Jesus said to them, Whose likeness and inscription is this? They said, Caesar's. Then he said to them, Therefore render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. And when they heard it, they marveled, and they left him and went away. Well, I guess most of us in the room long for a return to boring politics. And whatever your view is, and I'm not going to talk about it beyond after this point, whatever your view is about Brexit, whether you think it's a really good idea or a really bad idea, and whether you think May's plan is a good one or a bad one or one that needs tweaking or scrapping, I'm guessing quite a few people out there feel or have expressed that they feel sorry for her because whatever she said is wrong. It's just too Brexity or not Brexity enough, and it's going to upset someone or probably nearly everyone. Arguably most people are upset by it, and perhaps you can, though it's on a bigger scale, but perhaps you can have some sympathy, and you've had a similar experience where you just cannot be right. Whatever you do, whatever you say, it's wrong. Maybe even the same person is wrong, whatever you say. You have that stuck between a rock and a hard place, and maybe sometimes you have that experience of you move from one rock and hard place to another rock and hard place. And questions are coming at her at the moment, and maybe you've had this, where questions come at people that is just to catch them out. It's not to get clarity or understanding, it is just to catch them out. And often that is the case when we're talking about Christianity. Questions not to get an answer or a deeper understanding, but to catch the person out. And the deeper issue is often people want to avoid coming to Christ. And that's exactly what we have in the reading this morning, exactly what we have in front of us. A delegation is sent to Jesus to catch him out, and not much has changed. But it raises a deeper question, which is those of us here in the room, we also want to avoid going deeper and closer to Jesus. We want a limited discipleship. Jesus, I'll come this far, I'll come this close, and no more. And we come up with spurious questions and issues that limit it, particularly when things get uncomfortable. And things will get uncomfortable. So there are two parts to this passage, just very simply put, is there's a trap and there's an answer. So the first thing is the trap. In verses 15 to 17, it's clear from the outset that the aim of the question is not to get an answer. Verse 15, then the Pharisees went and plotted how to entangle him in his words. So there you have it, there's an aim to entangle him. And also there's an ungodly and unholy alliance. Verse 15, it says the Pharisees went. So they're the ones with the plan. Verse 16, along with the Herodians. And at the start of chapter 21, and it seems to be these conversations kind of flow one from the other from chapter 21. Verse 21 starts in the temple, and the temple leaders were the Sadducees. So we have three groups that are frequently mentioned in the Gospels with very different ideas. And you may know all of this, but just to remind you of the background, the Sadducees, they believed in only the Torah, so of what we call the Old Testament. They just believed in the first five books. Their Bible was the first five books. They did not believe in the resurrection. You may have heard the how you remember. They don't believe in the resurrection. That's why they're sad, you see. So we have more about them next week. But they're the Sadducees. No resurrection. They didn't believe in the spiritual realm. So things like angels and evil spirits, didn't believe in those. But they were the religious establishment. They were the leaders of the, mostly those who led the temple. So trying to think of equivalent terms, I used to work in the Church of England, as most of you know. In the Church of England, this is the House of Bishops. This is General Synod. So back in the day, that organisation would be culturally quite conservative in the way they viewed the world. But they were the establishment, but not necessarily believe in the supernatural realm to a full extent anyway. Pharisees believed in the whole Old Testament as we think of it. They believed in the supernatural, the resurrection, in angels and demons and so on. They were the equivalent, I suppose, of an evangelical lay movement of today, of which there's a number. And then the Herodians, well, as the name might suggest, they are pro-Herod and the establishment and Rome. They were very influenced by Greek culture, so they are ethnically Jewish. They would be religiously Jewish in their mind, but they were political establishment people. So they were religiously compromised. I suppose they liked, as some people today do, they liked a bit of civic religion, but for them, religion serves the politics. And you can see the inevitable tensions between the three of them. So the Pharisees and the Sadducees would see the Herodians as being compromised, as being culturally compromised, religiously compromised. The Herodians would see the others as scuppering the peace, particularly the Pharisees. The Pharisees would see the Sadducees as liberal, and the Sadducees would see the Pharisees as judgmental. And you can see how it would all go. And so the Sadducees had power in the temple, the religious power. The Herodians had the power in politics. And the Pharisees would have had quite a lot of popular support. People looked up to them. But these three groups are united. They're united now about Jesus. Jesus unites these three groups in their hatred of him. Jesus brings unity. Jesus frequently brings unity in opposition. And that can be seen today. So often you find this sort of thing where Islam and radical identity politics, which are serious odds with each other, and we'd be closer to either, are often united together and work together against Christ and his body. And often they're then backed by whatever you want to call them, liberal progressive movements in the church, to back them. And not much has changed. And the approach here is two-pronged. You may have noticed as it was read. First is flattery, and second is the rock and hard place. So there's flattery in the second half of verse 16. Teacher, we know that you are true and teach the way of God truthfully, and you do not care about anyone's opinion, for you are not swayed by appearances. Bit of flattery. And then they put in between the rock and the hard place, verse 17. Tell us then, what do you think? Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not? And the way they word the question, it demands a response. And whichever answer Jesus gives, he's going to fall out with one group or another. And potentially that falling out can lead him to danger. So if he says, no, do not pay tax, then there's a problem with the Herodians and probably the Sadducees. And not just them, but those who look up to that group and support that group. Not only so, but that would get him into trouble with the Romans, because now he's inciting rebellion and they have a way of dealing with that. If he says, yes, of course, pay tax, then probably he's going to run into problems with the Pharisees and those who look up to the Pharisees. Also, there's another group I've not mentioned called the Zealots. They were nationalists. I suppose if we're looking for equivalents today, this is 1980s IRA. This is Hezbollah. These are people who don't mind resorting to violence, or at least if someone commits violence, they'd go, well, you did ask for it. That's the Zealots. So Jesus is going to get in trouble with them. So at best, Jesus is going to lose a massive amount of popular following, whatever he says. And at worst, he's going to end up in prison or dead by what he says. So the aim is not to get an answer, but to lose support from a big sway of his following and to lead him into trouble. And questions that many people ask today, we have to ask questions back. So what is the question behind the question? No question comes raw. So why do you want to know that? It's always the first thing, politely, to ask somebody when they ask you a question. Is it a sincere question? And sometimes it is a plain, sincere, honest question. Sometimes there's something significant lying behind it, an experience they've had or a hang-up. And sometimes a question is just catching you out, trying to discredit Jesus and to try and make it sound like faith in him is just unreasonable. You know, I mean, the classic question is, can God create a rock that's too heavy for him to pick up? That is not, I would suggest, a sincere question. Other questions like, why does God allow suffering? That works on different levels. It can be sincere. It can be because of an experience or a hang-up. It can be just to catch you out. So you have to ask questions back. But there's a warning here, isn't there, of how people ask questions. And we'll see in a moment that we're not above doing that either. So the first thing is the trap, and that heart and attitude is still around. The second thing is the answer, verses 18 to 22. Jesus is not so easily tricked as we are. We have to ask questions back to find out what is the question behind the question. But Jesus knows what's in someone's heart. And the first thing he does is he exposes that. Verse 18. But Jesus, aware of their malice, said, "Why put me to the test, you hypocrites?" And he lays it out. This is not a real question. This is hypocrisy. And really at that point, they've cheated. It's quite legitimate now for Jesus to close down the conversation and leave it there. But he doesn't. Jesus hasn't been trapped. He now traps them. And the whole thing backfires on them. He asks them for a coin. They give him a denarii, which is normally the coin that's used for paying tax. And on one side of a denarii is the emperor's face. And it says, I don't know what it actually says, it's in Latin, but the translation is, "Tiberius Caesar, son of the divine Augustus." And on the other side, it said, "Pontifex Maximus." Pontifex means priest. So something like the high or the chief priest. So to most Jews, the actual currency, the coin, is, especially for a Pharisee, is highly offensive and blasphemous. There's an image. Now, for most Jews, that would have been pretty provocative in itself, that there's an image on it. But the image is claiming to be a man who is claiming to be divine in human form. And the high priest. He's claiming to be God come as a man and the way to God. That is a problem for Jews. As if paying taxes to a foreign power was not a sensitive enough issue to start with. So that's what Jesus says. Give me that coin. So this is quite a loaded thing already. And Jesus asks then, whose image is it? Well, just a straightforward factual answer. It's Caesar's, they said. And then we get Jesus' very famous reply. Verse 21, he said to them, "Therefore render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's." And this is a masterstroke. And he delivers here a double whammy. First, Caesar's what is Caesar's. Render to Caesar what is Caesar's. In other words, pay your tax. Even pay stupid taxes to unjust foreign powers, if and when they have power over you. And this is not a new idea. It's in Proverbs 8, verse 15. It comes up twice in Daniel 2, that foreign, unjust and foolish and or foreign powers are over, their laws apply, you pay your taxes. And the New Testament picks up on this. So Paul in Romans 13, Peter in 1 Peter 2, that we pay our taxes. that we obey the laws over us. And the reason why that is so, in Paul and Peter give, and as it comes up in the Old Testament, God is the king of the universe. And he places every ruler where they are, even if they don't know it, and even if they deny it and deny him. Even if they are bad, bad rulers are God's judgment on a nation. Even if they are elected as leaders, if they're born as leaders, if they conquered to become a leader, God put them there. And so, pay tax, obey the law, and so on. I've heard Christians before, I've heard Christian ministers advocate it. When I used to go to these sort of festivals and stuff, Christians saying, don't pay unjust taxes, as if we're a good arbiter of that. I think all my taxes are unjust. I don't pay any of them. People saying, don't pay unjust taxes. And when it happened, that was the council tax and the poll tax. It's not the point of whether they're just or right. Tax is something our society needs. True, some forms of taxation is counterproductive. True, government is not always the most efficient uses of money. They're not always trustworthy with it. But that's between them and God. And it's an amazing privilege we have in this country that we can vote. We effectively can sack our governments when we think they're not doing such a good job. Now, the first readers of the Bible were ruled by tyrants. Some of these tyrants worse than others. And they had to pay. And Paul and Peter and Jesus and the Old Testament says, pay it. But that's just the first blow Jesus delivers. Here's where he really turns the knife. He says to God, the things that are God's. So pay your tax, but to God, the things that are God's. So the coin bears Caesar's image. Just as the chocolate coins here bear some of the images of some of you. What bears God's image? So he says to the things that are God. So what bears God's image? Well, people do. You do. You bear God's image. So you pay your tax, you do other legal duties, but render to God's that which is God's. Well, what bears his image? You do. Give yourself to God. So they went to trap Jesus and they end up trapped and taking this to a deeper issue. Verse 22, they marveled at him. And that is the right response to an encounter with Jesus, isn't it? It's to marvel at him, at his wisdom. Well, what does it mean to render to God what's his? How do you pay your dues to God? If you don't pay tax, that's tax evasion. What does it mean to not give yourself to God? What is that? Well, we've said this sort of thing before, haven't we? That he is sovereign over every area of your life. It's seeing Jesus Christ as the rightful king of that life. And the theme we've passed through over the last few weeks in this bit of Matthew is this idea of presumption. That verses, on the one hand is presumption, the other side is responding in repentance and faith. That we want to live with Jesus as Lord of every area of our life. We've seen that we are naturally rebels against the king and that we need saving. And that Christ has done that, and Christ saves us by his self-giving. And so what do we offer back? There's nothing we can pay him back with. The debt we owe is eternal. And by right, he's king of the universe anyway. We bear his image. So what can we offer? Well, we can never repay, but we can offer our everything, ourselves. And often we feel, don't we, that God's law or his will in certain areas is restricting or it gets in the way, that it's not fair, that it's intrusive, it's a bit over the top. But you belong to God. That he is God, you are not God. And not only so, but he's paid this great price for you. What is this self-giving he gives, and what can we offer back? Well, I guess our self-giving covers everything. So our finances, so we give a portion, a percentage to gospel work, to the work of the church. Our time, and of what's left of our time and our money is in his goodness. We are left with some, but it's still, we have to use those things wisely in a God-honoring way, steward what God has given us. Gathering in worship as we do now, as we give of ourselves, this is what this is about. This is what we do. We gather and offer ourselves in worship. But of course, we do that with all of our life. Now, there's sort of two ways we can go in the wrong balance here. One is to say, we gather to worship. Well, I've done my worship bit for the week now, and the rest of the week is mine. Another one is where people sort of say, all of life is worship. So therefore, what we do now isn't that important. No, what we do now is important, but all of life is worship. Romans 12, living sacrifices, and so on. And so when you go to the workplace, your workplace is a place of worship where you are an ambassador for Christ, demonstrating God's kindness and consistency. Sometimes you're given the opportunity to speak, perhaps. The area of relationships are all under Christ's kingship, and we offer them to him. It's not a kind of, this is my area. It's all his. That alone we come to him. Often, as well, the way we give to Christ and offer ourselves to Christ is via his body, the church. Not just at the appointed times, like now in worship. But how we serve and care and love his people. You see, what is dear to Christ and who is dear to Christ should be dear to us. And so this is more than tax, isn't it? So tax, you pay whatever you're... It's all done directly through our banks normally, isn't it? But we pay what we're meant to pay and that's it. The rest is mine. And but it's different here, isn't it? That you are his possession. It's not we pay our tax to God, but you are his possession. All things, all this... Well, you know all this, don't you, already? But this passage just gives us a different angle and way of thinking about it. Not do this because you must. That's an element of truth there. Nor are we asking just, well, when is it enough? When have I given enough? We can be like this delegation that goes to Jesus here, don't we? Looking for a loophole. Ah, but if we do this, what about how does this apply here? We do it in all kinds of areas, but it's about finance or about coming to church or whatever it is, looking for the loophole. Rather, we need to see the relationship differently. I belong to him. And that this is not a chore. It's not a chore to give of ourselves to God. Augustine said this, "You have made us for yourself, O Lord, and our hearts are restless until it finds its rest in you." It's great, isn't it? "You have made us for yourself, O Lord, and our hearts are restless until it finds its rest in you." One traditional prayer says, "In whose service is found perfect freedom." We find our freedom by being a slave. That's a God-shaped hole sort of terminology. So it's a bit bland and twee, but you can see how it picks up on Augustine's point, doesn't it? It means that everyone is made in God's image. Everyone bears his image, and we need to offer ourselves to him. And deep down we know it, and although we protest otherwise, when we do protest otherwise, we're restless until we find our rest in him. And the more we come under his kingship, rather than doing the equivalent of spiritual tax evasion, it's not the poorer we are, but the richer we are. "Therefore, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's." What is worship? Well, actually, we're going to think about that tonight. What is worship? But often when we talk about worship, we talk about things that we do, what we like or don't like or prefer. Worship is about Christ. Worship is about God, Father, Son, and Spirit. And that our attitude is expressing his worth, our love and gratitude. And then also part of it is receiving from him, showing that we're depending on him, which is an honouring thing, and offering back our lives and ourselves. And it is not looking for loopholes. Matthew 22, 15 to 22 is a call to worship. And so what we're doing this morning is, well, this afternoon is now, this is a call to worship. To do what we are doing now and to understand what we're doing now and to worship with all of what we have. Let's pray. "Therefore, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's." We thank you for this insight into all of our lives, of how we relate to our rulers, but also our ultimate ruler, you. And so although we may query the wisdom of our leaders and our laws, help us to be good subjects, good citizens, but more than that, that we'd be good citizens of heaven, that we would in worship offer ourselves when we gather, but also with everything that we own and that we have, because we bear your image. Please move in our hearts, we ask in Jesus' name. Amen.